It's a pretty gutsy move to just blatantly lie about such basic things like whether or not someone is your lawyer. But aside from the chutzpah, it might reveal something deeper. Like, is this pathological? Could he just not help it? Because all you have to do is call the lawyer and ask, hey, do you represent this guy? And if the lawyer says, I have no idea who that person is, what are you talking about? Then you know for a fact that the person you're dealing with is a bald-faced liar.
If you'd like to earn CPE credit for listening to this episode, visit earmarkcpe.com, download the app, take a short quiz, and get your CPE certificate. Continuing education has never been so easy. And now, on to the episode.
This is Oh My Fraud, a true crime podcast that features con men instead of contract killers. I'm Caleb Newquist.
And I'm Greg Kite.
How's your self-esteem today, Greg? Doing okay?
Oh, my self-esteem is high but fragile, as usual.
Okay, so a five-star review, will that help you out?
Yeah, a five-star review shouldn't bruise my delicate flower of a self-image.
Okay, fantastic. Because I have one, and it is from Fezda. Fezda writes on Apple Podcasts, best podcast ever. I found your podcast from my amazing sister. I am not a CPA or even an accountant. I am a nurse with an MBA healthcare focus. I have learned so much just from listening to your podcast. You keep it entertaining and my brain doesn't stray. Thank you. I appreciate you and your time you give us. Maybe one day you'll give us a tax fraud case related to healthcare. Keep up the strong work.
Nice. Best podcast ever from a non-accountant listener even. That's amazing. If you're a non-accountant or even a accountant who learns something or are sufficiently entertained, or at least your brain doesn't stray while you're listening to our podcast, we'd love you to leave us a rating and a review on your favorite podcast platform, whatever that may be. And also, Thesta, if you're listening, check out episode 10. That was about the Four Seasons Nursing Center. It is a healthcare fraud, maybe not a healthcare tax fraud, but still it's in the healthcare arena. Maybe check that gem out.
Yeah, it's a deep cut, that one.
Yep.
That was episode 10?
That was episode 10.
Good night.
Time flies, man.
All right. We appreciate all the reviews. And also, just to put it out there, we do keynote addresses on fraud and ethics at events and conferences or for in-house trainings. So if that is of interest to you, please get in touch. And don't worry, we're pros. We can work clean if that's what you need.
If you want more info on pricing and availability of our speaking, please send us an email at ohmyfraud@earmarkcpe.com.
Okay, Greg, getting into it. When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? Do you remember?
No, I don't, but that's because there were so many things.
Oh, okay.
What I do remember is every week when I was growing up, there was a new thing that I wanted to be. I remember wanting to be a chef. I remember wanting to be a taxi cab driver and a push cart owner operator and even a porn star, because I was exposed to Playboy magazine way too early by anyone's standards.
It sure.
was way too early. And I was like, yeah. Oh, could I get paid for that? Then I need to start brushing up my porn resume. Then one day I remember being with my grandpa Kite, and I was rehearsing all the different careers I wanted to be. I mean, all the careers I wanted to be except this one that I just left off the list.
Was it Grandpa Kite's Playboy?
No, I'm not going to narc out who the irresponsible adult was.
Okay. All right.
But I do, this is indelibly in my brain, where I was telling him all these ideas, and my grandpa was who coolest guy. I loved my grandpa Kite.
Nice.
He was even as a child, I remember him just being like interested in what I had to say.
Yeah.
And
cool.
Maybe he was faking it, but he faked it good if he did.
Great. That's a great grandparent right there.
Right. And he was like, listen, if you really want to make money, kid, get into the insurance racket. That was his advice.
Wow.
So that made the list just because, you know,
he wasn't,
Kite,
Apparently he wasn't concerned about you dying of boredom.
Right, right. But he was like, if you want the long green, if you want the all the cheddar, I think is what he said. Yeah. Go into that insurance racket. But then when I was 13, I converted to evangelical Christianity. Oh. I got born again. I converted hard. And from then on, it was like I wanted to be a missionary or a youth pastor. And that was kind of it from that point on. So
we don't have time to get into this now, but one day you're gonna tell me the story of your conversion because 13, about 13 was about the time where I'm just like, I'm not going to do this.
Right. We're not going to get into it.
We're not going to get into it. No. We'll have to have that exchange.
What about you? What kind of stuff did you want to?
I was going to be a baseball player. Kite.
There you go.
Yeah. I loved baseball as a kid, and I wanted to be a professional baseball player. I wanted to play for the Chicago Cubs. What else did I want to be? I also wanted to be David Letterman. As a kid. I mean, nice. I would have been a teenager probably by the time I didn't watch the old Letterman, but I loved Letterman as a young guy who loved making people laugh, but also loved laughing. I just thought Letterman was so wacky and funny. But it was one of those things where like, how the fuck do you become a talk show host? Like, how do you get that job?
I was going to say, and now here you are, and I'm your Paul Schaefer. Everything came together. I'm your less musical, but still the same hairdo, Paul Schaefer.
You do have the Paul hair.
I rock the Paul hair. And Caleb, the reason we're talking about childhood dreams of what our careers might be is because in today's episode, our main character, he had very specific dreams of what he wanted to do as an adult. And he, in a weird and twisted way, was able to make those childhood dreams come true.
Frederick Darren Muskopf grew up in Oregon with his mother, three siblings, and dad, a butcher turned car salesman turned river guide, who also happened to be a mean drunk. A Seattle Met article describes Darren as, quote, an obedient, outgoing, and industrious kid, but the old man considered him a sissy. Still, the old man saved the beatings for his older two sons, who then paid it forward to Darren.
As good older brothers do.
Indeed. Darren's sister says that when he was about 8 years old, he created an alter ego for himself named Rod Taylor, quote, a smart, invincible character who never failed. My personal favorite.
Right. It wasn't so much an alter ego. It was just a cool name me and my brother came up with.
Oh?
Biff Malibu.
Fantastic.
1980s, that was right down Main Street.
Yeah, it
for
is.
For a character name, but we didn't get much further than that. Would be a cool name for
the fact that you remember it is all
Biff,
I need.
Biff Malibu,
a little bit of Miami Vice, or not even Miami Vice. I don't know what that is. It's a little bit Back to the Future, and then something else.
Just on brand for mid 80s, whatever it was,
for sure. This alter ego ran a bus company. Yep. Darren's grandfather drove for Greyhound and talked about his adventures, and Darren regularly immersed himself in this world, quote, away from the chaos of his real life. His parents divorced in Darren's teens, and later, after his mom remarried, he took his stepfather's last name, Berg. When he left home, Darren enrolled at the University of Oregon in Eugene. At Oregon, Darren pledged with Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity and later became the chapter's treasurer and president. But he also owned a charter bus company, the company of his childhood dreams. As treasurer, one of Berg's responsibilities was collecting the rent of his fraternity brothers. Then one day, in October 1983, the landlord called the alumni advisor to the fraternity, a CPA by the name of Michael Stone, and asked, where's the rent money?
Oh, so he just wasn't getting it.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, he wanted to know where the fucking money was, Lebowski. Anyway, Stone started going over the fraternity's bank statements. This all struck him as weird. Okay.
So
So he started going over the fraternity's bank statements, and it soon became clear that Darren had collected the rent, and instead of paying the landlord, he put the money into his charter bus company.
Because that's how dreams come true, man.
That's right. So the CPA, Michael Stone, confronted Darren, and when this happened, Darren resigned, but then he denied everything in a letter to Stone. And I'm reading from that letter from one of the sources that everything's in the show notes. But here we go. Quote, "A word for the record," Berg wrote, "I have at no time ever embezzled any funds from Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity. What an erroneous assumption. It's for this reason that I welcome your audit. As always, you will find a reason for everything I have done. My bookkeeping will be no exception. Any money deposited into any account will have a tangible and reasonable explanation." It goes on, "Unfortunately, I will be unable to participate in your Perry Mason game," he wrote, directing Stone to a certain local attorney. "He has paid good money to answer stupid questions, and I'm sure he'll be happy to answer yours." So this Darren, he's got a little sass.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a little sass or a lot of confidence. Because listen, this was a few years ago now. I had this weird random email that somebody that I pissed off sent to a bunch of the owners in my building that accused me of embezzling and abusing my position that I have with, and I took a very similar position to this where I was like, it's false, but and so because of that, let's go as deep into the books as you want, and I'll show you everything you need to see. So there's
good for you.
this is but that's the thing. It's just the accusations weren't false here, but whether accusations are false or not, you can have that hardcore. Yeah, CPA, let's look into this. Let's audit this shit. Bring it on, because you'll see that everything I do has a tangible and reasonable explanation, bitch. And that's sort of the swagger that I see is like, yeah. Because again, if you're being accused of that stuff and you're like, bring it on, that's a way to have people go, oh, I guess maybe, you know, seemed like he was doing a good, I guess.
Right. So Michael Stone called the lawyer, and the lawyer had no idea who Darren Berg was.
Brilliant.
Amazing. Berg quit the fraternity, dropped out of school, and then later turned up in Portland, where a few years later, he was charged with bank fraud for stealing $30,000 in a check-kiting scheme, which I know we've talked about check-kiting before, but that is the check-kiting might be the dumbest fraud that a person can do.
It's pretty much the dumbest fraud.
Like, it's just so ridiculous, and we don't have time to get into it. I love how dumb check-kiting schemes are. Yeah.
I love the name check kiting. It feels like it's part of my family history.
Yeah, it's part of you, but right.
Yeah.
But anyway.
But there was, it seems like from what we looked in the research, there were no repercussions for the $21,000.
There was
that we
not.
Saw.
No. So what Stone did is he went to the authorities in Eugene, and at that time, they just weren't interested. They weren't interested in pursuing anything. And it just kind of went away.
Jeez.
And then
$21,000. Just here you go.
Yeah, I guess.
Oof.
Yeah.
Oof. Okay.
And as far as like the check kiting scheme, he actually did get busted for that. Berg was convicted, but did no jail time. The judge sentenced him to probation.
Berg moved to Seattle in 1989. That's my hometown. He wanted to start anew, and he spent the next decade building a business that bought and sold mortgages. And he eventually launched what was known as Meridian Mortgage Funds in 2001. Berg started and operated several investment funds and focused on real estate, mortgage-backed securities. So that's a little red flag right there in hindsight. And but this was also interesting. He also specialized in seller financed real estate contracts, or like private mortgages. So right. If you were wanting to buy my house and I go, cool, you can buy it, just pay me over time with an right. interest rate. That's a private mortgage. That's a seller financed estate it's, contract.
Do you, and that's do you, a, are you familiar with those at all? Like, have you never?
I know, not firsthand. I know okay. that they exist, but I yes. don't think I know any. I think I might have. I think the first house that I bought, I think the guy who sold it to me offered to finance it himself.
Oh, really?
And I was even though I knew him, it mm-hmm. was probably because I knew him where I was like, no thanks, we'll go to it. To a right. bank legit.
It just always felt weird. It just feels weird to me. It's like you would have to be in a pretty tough situation where you're just going to work with the person selling you the house yeah. on the yeah, financing.
Yeah. Right.
Like, or so, there's a bank on every corner in this fucking country. Just go, like, they'll tell you whether or not you can get the house or not.
Right.
Hey folks, Caleb Newquist here, co-host of Oh My Fraud. If you're an advertiser or marketer who wants to reach an engaged audience of accounting and finance professionals, why not advertise on Oh My Fraud? Use our self-service ad platform to browse our inventory and book the slots that fit your marketing budget. From there, it will only be a matter of time before you hear us telling our listeners your company's story. Head over to ohmyfraud.com/sponsor to get your campaign started. That's ohmyfraud.com/sponsor.
Another thing about Berg, though, as he launched Meridian, is he possessed a kind of unflappable confidence, the kind that really that investors love. He sold them on his ability to manage the risk and to give them consistent returns. And there was hundreds of investors who put their money with Meridian. So in essence, they put their money with Berg. Here's a quote. Two local wealth advisory firms, Cornerstone Advisors and Kibble and Prentice, counseled many investors to invest with Meridian. Others came to Meridian's orbit through friends or relatives wowed by the steady earnings it reported and the payouts they got whenever they asked. Quote, my oldest friend was getting checks every month, 10%, I think, and for years, said Ron Neubauer, a former federal prosecutor who put money into Meridian in 2006. Quote, the thing that impressed me the most about it was that he had audited financials from a national firm. So in just under a decade, Berg was able to raise $350 million from investors in 20 different states. The other thing investors loved about Berg was that he just exuded success. He was always dressed immaculately. He had yachts, not a yacht. He had multiple yachts, but the multiple was two. He had two private jets. He had a mansion on Mercer Island. That's big shit.
You know the area. Yeah, so is that a big deal?
Oh my gosh. That's a shack on Mercer Island's a big deal.
Okay.
So a mansion on Mercer Island is a huge deal, but his mansion on Mercer Island also had a full-time staff. Plus he owned multiple homes in California. So kind of the idea is if the guy I'm investing with has all that kind of cash, he's got to be good at investing.
You bet.
Because that's how he got his money too.
Right.
And on top of that, Caleb, there was the buses.
Oh, yeah.
He started a new charter bus company called MTR Western. And by all accounts, building MTR Western was a dream come true for little boy Berg, who made good on his childhood dreams of not having toy buses anymore, but having an actual fleet of kick-ass tour buses. He spared no expense when it came to his bus company. The buses had oak floors, not pine floors, not plastic floors.
Mahogany?
Not mahogany.
Mahogany would be nice, but
it was oak floors. They had to Think of the maintenance. He interviewed all the drivers. He dressed them in uniforms that came from Nordstrom. What? I don't have clothes from Nordstrom, but his bus drivers did. The Seattle Seahawks and the Oregon Ducks were customers, and even a governor of Washington State used one for his reelection campaign. Berg threw lavish parties for the drivers and other employees of the bus company. There's even a story about how he paid Ben Folds and John Mayers to play at one of the events for his bus drivers. Now,
was that the case? Was it for bus drivers, or was he trying to win business with the concerts?
I think it was for the bus drivers, but it's unclear, I guess, from the account.
We'll take this offline right now, but like,
leave this in because it doesn't affect the story at all.
No, it does not. No, it does not.
So the experience of the MTR Western Busing Company was amazing. However, the experience of the Meridian Investment employees, totally opposite. One of the former HR managers for Meridian tells the story of when he quit after Berg, quote, flew into a rage, screaming at me and everyone in the office. He picked up a stapler and threw it at me from across the space. That's amazing. That's called passion, is what that's called. Other employees of Meridian Investments remember him throwing other things too, including laptops and coffee mugs. A couple of the things I don't really want to get knocked in the head with are laptops and coffee mugs.
Definitely.
Employees say that everything had to run through Darren, that he kept his people in silos, and that he was often stressed or angry and would never, ever admit to being wrong.
In March 2009, Darren Berg spoke to a group of his investors in Meridian's Seattle office. Just 4 months earlier, Bernie Madoff had been arrested, and investors all over the country were on edge. Berg, poised as always, reassured his investors. Quote, "There's no magic here," he said. "You might think it's magic, but it's actually real meat and potatoes stuff."
Yeah, you know, meat and potatoes, like mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah. Real meat and potatoes.
No bet. I just got to go between Madoff and between the fact that the 2008 financial crisis was largely tainted by mortgage-backed securities. There's a lot of stink that's got to be coming Berg's way because of both of those things.
It's not aging well.
No.
Berg's investors hung in with him. And why wouldn't they? Many had received consistent returns on their investments for years. But one big investor, Cornerstone Investments, wanted out and requested a redemption of $30 million. Berg couldn't pay it. By August 2009, Meridian told its investors that it could not honor any redemption requests. No one could get their money out. And just in case there's any confusion, that is not good.
Yeah.
Not good.
Yeah, when you go to the bank and say, "I'd like to make a withdrawal," and they're like, "Yeah, we're not going to let you." That's
right.
That's a pretty good red flag.
Most people have seen It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, I have not.
I really haven't either, but there is a bank run. But there is a bank run. It's famous for
that. We both heard of a pop culture, very widely known pop culture reference of a bank run, but we're not. Personally,
don't.
That's where we're the only two people who haven't seen It's a Wonderful Life.
I have a friend who watches it every Christmas.
I don't know. Whenever I tell someone I've never seen it, they're like, "What? Right. How did you get through without watching it?" It's like, yeah.
I chose Home Alone instead. Not hard.
right.
But by June 2010, Cornerstone moved to force some of the Meridian funds into bankruptcy. As those investigations move forward and the authorities started to close in, Berg decided that he had wanted to cooperate and get to the bottom of what went wrong. In July 2010, Berg's attorney explained to investigators that starting around 2008, Berg started moving money around to keep his businesses solvent and try to hold things together until the market stabilized, and then he could sell his assets to honor investors' redemptions. Except that never happened.
But it was a real attorney, though.
It was a real attorney.
Nice.
So
nice. good. He can learn.
Yeah.
Burglar can learn from his past mistakes.
Yeah. Slightly better.
Good.
A bankruptcy trustee by the name of Mark Calvert was appointed to control the money that was left on behalf of Meridian's investors. Berg seemed cooperative, meeting with Calvert and his team regularly and, quote, appeared candid about his missteps and wanted to help them, quote, navigate the many records that would allow him to piece them together.
So, what was going on at Meridian, you might be asking? The answer is a lot of things. Mark Calvert, the bankruptcy guy, discovered that it all started in 2003 when Berg used $4 million from one of the Meridian funds to help grow his fledgling tour bus company. Again, maybe he can't learn from his mistakes. Berg faked loans using all kinds of bogus paperwork, title reports, loan applications, etc., from proposed deals that never actually happened. The loans became real files, documentation that ended up on Meridian Fund's books. This gave the appearance that the diverted cash that went to Berg's bus company and his houses and his boats and his jets actually became an asset on his financial statements, because he was saying that those monies were actually loaned instead of just spent frivolously. But there was one problem. Those fake assets would have to result in actual interest. If you own a loan as an asset, its revenue stream is the interest that you're charging the borrower. But there was no borrower and there was no interest income. Another thing Berg did is that he would sell an actual loan, a real one that Meridian had made, but he wouldn't record the sale. And where did the money end up? Who the hell knows? Not in Meridian's bank accounts, that was for sure. Berg told prosecutors that he, quote, spent countless hours fabricating documents.
Now, you might be wondering, what about those audited financial statements from a national accounting firm? Well, that also required another gargantuan effort on Berg's part. Part of the procedures that Moss Adams would do to audit the Meridian funds included confirming the borrower's identities by mailing loan confirmation letters to them.
Yes.
Right. So if you're not an accountant, we're gonna explain this a little bit. So if you don't know what these are, these confirmation letters ask the recipients to confirm their information, right? Just to say, yep, it's correct.
Yeah. Okay. I've received confirmation letters at work for companies that we, what is it? Yeah. It's been for banks that we have received loans from.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay.
So
great. In this case, in the Meridian case, it would be the information of loan borrowers, right? Because Meridian owns the loans, right? So
yep.
You can imagine that those confirmations would have, you know, name of the borrower, address, loan balance, stuff like that.
Yep.
Right.
And when you receive, and that's exactly the kind that I would receive.
Yep.
And when I would receive them, some of them are like, this is what we have on the books. Is that the correct balance?
Right.
And you just have to check yes and then sign it and turn it back. Some of them say, you have a loan
complete
with this
it.
Bank, write in what your loan balance is. So there's,
yeah,
there's
as
two
of a
kinds.
Particular date. Yep.
Yep. Exactly. Yep.
Right. The auditors typically include a pre-addressed postage paid return envelope in their requests. So as Greg just eloquently explained, all the recipient has to do is fill out the info or confirm it.
Yeah.
Stick it in the envelope and drop it in the mail.
Right.
Very easy.
If I have to lick a stamp, you're not getting your fucking
confirmation. Yeah, you're not getting your fucking
As someone who's confirming this stuff, you're under no obligation to confirm it.
That is correct.
So they're just hoping that you're going to play the game.
Yep. But remember, the borrowers aren't real.
Right. Right.
So
With Meridian.
Right. With Meridian.
It was all fake.
Yeah. Borrowers aren't real. So how did these phantom borrowers actually respond to the confirmation request? Because the financial statements are audited, Greg
yeah,
Kite.
Right.
Right?
So this is clearly how the fraud fell apart, right, Caleb?
No. Get this. Get this. Berg opened scores of post office boxes under fake names and forwarded all the mail sent to those PO boxes to an address in Seattle. So remember, he's got fake borrowers, fake names, fake addresses.
Yeah.
He opened PO boxes.
Scores of them.
Scores of them.
Not dozens of them. We're talking like.
Well, scores means dozens.
Scores means 20.
Scores. I thought scores meant dozens.
No, a score is 20.
All right. Well, 20,
score and 7 years ago. That's 87 years ago.
Somewhere in between dozens and scores.
Okay. Here's the thing. Some listener out there who's nerdier than the two of us needs to settle this.
This is semantics. It's not accounting.
Okay. Right. Well, I'm going to Google it right now.
Okay. Well, anyway, I'm going to continue talking.
Yeah, you anyway. Do that.
All right. Berg opens scores.
20. It's 20.
Fine. Berg opened lots of post office boxes under fake names and forwarded all the mail sent to those PO boxes to an address in Seattle. Then he completed the confirmations himself.
Nice.
And mailed them back to Moss Adams.
Brilliant.
I don't know how much time he spent doing all that.
And he did this himself. He was not having an unpaid intern do this for
him. By all the accounts that I read.
Yeah.
He was doing this all himself.
Right. Right. Well, right. Because wasn't there even something where like the handwriting was that?
Yes. Yes. Didn't we? Yes. No, let me go on. I'll continue.
Yeah. Please.
According to the bankruptcy trust, according to Mark Calvert, that's the bankruptcy trustee, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Moss Adams didn't notice that most of the confirmations it sent out were going to post office boxes. And that, if you're an auditor, you know this, but if you're not, you don't. That is usually frowned upon.
Okay.
You don't like if part of the, I remember being a young auditor and managers would be like, can't be a post office box. It's got to go somewhere. It's got to go somewhere like real.
Yeah. So Darren Berg rents all these PO boxes all over the place. And he uses those PO box addresses as the addresses for the fake documentation for the fake loans. Moss Adams gets those fake addresses. They send confirmations to those fake addresses, but all those PO boxes are instructed to just forward whatever comes to them to forward them to Darren Berg,
yes.
Who then opens them, fills them out himself, puts them back in the self-addressed stamped envelope, business return envelope, and mails them back to Moss Adams.
Correct.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's dedication.
Yeah.
That's meth addict level dedication.
Yeah.
This episode of Oh My Fraud is sponsored by Webgility. Webgility is the number one QuickBooks connector for multi-channel sellers and accountants who support them. Designed specifically for e-commerce and multi-channel sellers, Webgility seamlessly integrates with over 50 platforms, including Shopify, Amazon, and Walmart, making it the perfect solution for your clients. Webgility takes the hassle out of e-commerce accounting by automating the flow of data into QuickBooks. Sales, returns, expenses, fees, and inventory are all accurately recorded, ensuring your clients' financials are always up to date and tax compliant, allowing you to stay out of the e-commerce weeds and instead focus on high value add consulting services. But Webgility isn't just about software, it's about a partnership. As a Webgility certified partner, you gain access to exclusive benefits like co-marketing activities, additional revenue streams, and free expert onboarding, so there's no hassle getting your clients set up. With comprehensive training and unparalleled support, you'll be equipped to deliver even more value to your e-commerce client, helping them run more profitable businesses. Don't let manual accounting tasks slow you down. To join the thousands of accounting professionals who trust Webgility to streamline their e-commerce accounting, head over to omyfraud.promo/webgility. That is omyfraud.promo/WEBGILITY.
According to Mark Calvert, Moss Adams didn't notice that most of the confirmations it sent out were going to post office boxes, which is generally frowned upon, but yes. Then also coming back with the same handwriting.
Right. Do you think you would notice that?
I don't know. Like in the account that I read that I found that bit of information, that is something where I found myself wondering, it's like, but would a person notice?
Yeah.
Cause like, what, I mean, do auditors need to be handwriting experts now? Because it's, that's a bridge too far maybe. Huh?
And it's mind numbing work too.
Totally.
You're opening an envelope. You're looking at a number. you're checking a box, when you're going to the next one.
When you are dealing with a business like Meridian, where you have, who even knows how many loans they had on their books? I mean, they had zero loans on their books pretty much, but like purportedly, right? What are we talking about? Hundreds of loans, thousands of loans? Like we don't know, right? But if you're confirming these as part of your procedures as an auditor, you're certainly doing, I don't know, say you're doing several dozen, okay, 30, 40. It's like, can you imagine being the young auditor on that job, licking every goddamn envelope? Like there's a
they're not all coming in on the same day.
No, of course not.
So that's another reason you're not going to notice necessarily if the handwriting, you're going to have to really be paying attention. But at the same time, I could see where people, that's one of the things that people would get pissy about, where it's like, you didn't notice it was the same handwriting on every single one.
Yes, right.
And then it's like, you don't understand the
job. No, some armchair auditing going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But regardless, he got it through Moss Adams, even though there was ways for them to catch it. I guess that's sort of the moral of that part of the story.
Yeah. So Berg was giving investigators a lot of information and things were starting to make sense, but he still wasn't being completely honest.
Darren Berg had shared a lot about the operations of Meridian. He'd voluntarily sort of, with his arm twisted, given a lot of information about the operations of Meridian. Investigators knew that he had put more than $30 million of investor money into his tour bus company, put millions more in a construction company that he owned, and he spent millions, obviously, on his lavish lifestyle. Meridian and Berg were both in bankruptcy by this point, and that allowed Mark Calvert, the bankruptcy guy, to put many of these assets, including the crown jewel, the bus company, into bankruptcy proceedings in an effort to recover the missing investor funds. Meridian had very little real assets behind the mortgage funds. Calvert said that those funds only had $11 million backing them up, while Berg had raised about $130 million and reported to investors that they had earned $80 million on that. But Berg still hadn't provided Calvert with access to certain bank accounts and post office boxes. This made Calvert suspicious that some assets were being hidden, of course. And in October of 2010, a consultant working for Calvert found a bank account in Berg's name that hadn't been reported. The bank account was only 1 month old, and according to an investigative report in the Seattle Met, the consultant saw that $145,000 had been transferred to this account from yet another account that Berg had opened only in February that had $225,000 wired to it shortly thereafter. So Berg told investigators that the money was for consulting work that he'd done after he declared bankruptcy. So he was entitled to keep it. It was like, I declared bankruptcy already, so now this is part of my fresh start. I've been out there consulting because I'm a business genius.
Right.
And this is my honest earned money. I get to keep that. Hands off, motherfucker. The small problem with that consulting work, though, the contracts show that the work was, quote, related to owning corporate jets. And investigators can only find one person who had supposedly signed an agreement for this consulting work, but that purported client's name was A, spelled wrong, and B, the client said their signature was faked. So sounds like a pi kappa epsilon rent again.
Indeed.
Turns out that money had actually come from the sale of another one of Berg's homes that had gone unnoticed by investigators. Berg spent the money from the proceeds of the unnoticed home, quote, on lease payments for two Porsches, 12 months advance rent on an apartment in Los Angeles. It went to an Audi convertible. It went to insurance on jet skis and a yacht and a retainer for a criminal defense attorney. Because let me tell you, if you're bilking investors out of millions of dollars, you can still it's unexcusable for your jet skis to be uninsured. I just think that's just common knowledge.
Yeah. That's just, that's, those are table stakes, man.
In October 21st, 2010, Darren Berg was arrested. Finally, he was charged with 9 counts of wire fraud and 1 count of money laundering. Prosecutors wanted Berg detained before the trial because they worried he was a flight risk. Maybe because he had had access to private jets and was consulting other people who had private jets, or at least saying he was consulting other people who had private jets. They had uncovered evidence that he had tried to establish an offshore trust in Belize, so maybe he was going to flee to Belize. Berg claimed that he was trying to insure some of his remaining assets, but nobody was buying it. A judge ordered that Berg be held, at least partially based on the fact that his cooperation with investigators had been inconsistent and manipulative. Eventually, another indictment came down, adding another charge of money laundering and 1 count of bankruptcy fraud, which bankruptcy fraud seems like a no-brainer. Berg claimed that his businesses were legit and that the financial crisis put him into, quote, survival mode as he tried to save the business and satisfy investors. Prosecutors didn't buy any of that and said that Berg lied repeatedly to investors to raise the money. All told, Berg had fleeced more than 500 investors out of more than $100 million. And on August 2nd, 2011, Darren Berg pleaded guilty to 1 count of wire fraud, 1 count of money laundering, and 1 count of bankruptcy fraud. He was sentenced to 18 years in federal prison in February of 2012.
Many of Darren Berg's victims were just regular people just trying to save money for retirement. In the many accounts of this case that we found, victims talked about having to go back to work after retirement, selling their homes, and other major lifestyle changes. Around the time that investigators were building their case against Berg, Mark Calvert, the bankruptcy trustee that we keep bringing up, he told investigators that they could expect to recover only 9 to 20% of the money they invested with Berg.
Oof.
Yeah. According to the 2018 report from the Seattle Met, it had risen to 26 to 28%. Better.
Then they're fine.
but maybe not. J.A. Jantz, the mystery novelist, maybe some of you have heard of. Anyway, she's written lots of books. When I was looking into this, she has written many books. So she's a mystery novelist. J.A. Jantz, the mystery novelist, was one of Berg's victims. She and her husband lost about $500,000. And Jantz actually wrote a book inspired by her experience entitled Clawback. Except this time, the perp of the Ponzi scheme is murdered at the beginning of the story.
Because it's her story.
Yeah, it's her story. That's
she
right.
can live out her fantasies in her own mystery novel.
That's right. And it's no wonder when you listen to her talk about her experience, she was there's a couple places that are in the show notes. The AARP podcast, The Perfect Scam, and CNBC's American Greed, they both featured this story. And J.A. Jantz, she is pissed.
Yeah.
She's super pissed. And rightly so, right?
Yeah.
But she readily admits, however, that she and her husband were lucky. She, you know, she's a published author and she has a steady stream of income from the sale of her books. Many of Berg's victims were not so lucky. Berg's fraud, like all investment frauds, had a devastating impact on people's lives. These are people who trusted Darren Berg and they liked him. The betrayal felt incredibly personal for them, but the profound pain caused by Berg's betrayal managed to get worse.
The U.S. Penitentiary in Atwater, California is about 130 miles southeast of San Francisco. This high security prison hosts notable prisoners, including Muhammad Salad Ali, who was a Somali pirate who was convicted for the 2011 hijacking of a civilian yacht where 4 Americans were killed. It also housed Jerry Alfred Whitworth, who was part of the Walker family spy ring, Whitworth was convicted of spying for the Soviet Union in 1986, and he was sentenced to 365 years in prison, a sentence that he will clearly be able to fulfill to the last day. In 2016, Darren Berg was serving time not at the penitentiary in Atwater, where there are high fences lined with razor wires and six guard towers, but he was at the minimum security satellite campus adjacent to the penitentiary. The Seattle Met describes this camp as having minimal fencing and security because the prisoners are considered so low risk. There are basketball courts and a track and field and a softball diamond. The men must keep books and other belongings inside their personal lockers. Only one framed photo outside is okay. And they're generally all required to work, serving food in the cafeteria or helping maintain the site for less than a dollar a day. On December 6, 2017, at 3:30 p.m., a corrections officer did a routine afternoon count of the prisoners, and he came up one short because Darren Berg had disappeared.
The U.S. Bureau of Prisons notified the U.S. Marshals Service, which put out a wanted poster for Berg the next day. But by most accounts, there was no trace of him. He had just walked away. Naturally, Berg's victims were incensed at the escape, especially since many of them protested that he would be serving his sentences in minimum security facilities. One investor told the Seattle Met back in 2018, quote, "I hope he's hiding out racked with paranoia in some rat-infested, mosquito-ridden dunghole fearing for his shitty life." Which is pretty much what I would have said. So,
right.
But sadly, that is unlikely given the most recent reporting on where Berg may be.
Oh.
An Associated Press report from April 2019 suggested that he may be hiding out in Brazil. At that time, authorities were focused on Berg's boyfriend, Daryl Ray Blankenship, quote, "a flight attendant with international connections and apparent access to a private jet."
Ah, there it is.
There were several suspicious links between the two men, including one, photos posted by Blankenship weeks after Berg's escape of several men in Brazil, one of whom had a similar hairline to Berg's, which is a strange thing to use as an identifying characteristic,
yeah,
especially since Darren Berg has a completely normal hairline.
Right. I also,
like, if you look at pictures of him, you would not go, "No, I didn't remember that hairline anywhere." Like, that's not what, it's not that kind of a hairline.
Well,
it's not a Costanza. We're not talking about the Larry Fine here, you know?
Right. Well, but even, I mean, I have the same hairline as Paul Schaefer.
Correct.
I am also definitely not Paul Schaefer. There's a lot of other guys who have completely shaved domes, and doesn't seem like that narrows it down, but they felt like it did.
Right. Somehow it made it into that AP story.
Right.
Anyway, another link, a message sent by Blankenship to Berg's mother at the time saying, "Hello from Rio."
That's sketchy.
Weird.
Yeah.
A message sent to a tarot card reader, which, okay, in early 2018 signed Daryl and Darren. And finally, an Instagram message sent from Blankenship to a mutual friend saying he had, quote, "just heard from Darren." Based on all the research we did for this episode, in the last 5 years, there has been no developments on the whereabouts of Darren Berg. Greg, Kite, did we learn anything?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a few things, you know, and again, there's things that were highlighted to me. One of the things was in one of the accounts, I know there was some accounts where people said that investors were getting a 10% return on their investment, which is a really good return.
It is.
But it's not astronomical.
Right.
And again, I think it was in the Seattle Met article where I read that there was people who had gotten a consistent 7% return for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And 7%, very modest. Like, there's better investments than 7%. And one of the things that we've seen and that we pointed out in prior Ponzi schemes is that your Ponzi scheme is more likely to succeed for longer if you're not promising wild returns, because for a couple reasons. First off, wild returns, that's a red flag.
Yep.
That's probably going to get you caught. But then the other thing is, if you're promising more modest returns, you're not going to have to pull in as much new money to pay out your old money. So it's more sustainable if you're promising a smaller return. But that also, and this is something that we saw way back, was it episode 2 we did the mutual benefits company?
Was it called Mutual Benefits Corporation?
Friends with Mutual Benefits, I think, right. Was what we called it.
That was
it.
The name of the episode. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, but, and so similar to that Ponzi scheme, neither of them started out as Ponzi schemes. That was something I also remember reading in the literature, is that investigators were confident that this didn't, the intention from the get-go wasn't, oh, I'm going to start a Ponzi scheme and I'm going to screw people out of money.
Yeah.
He was legitimately collecting money and investing money, and then got to a point where he was like, oh, or I could take some of this money for me. And so it morphed into a Ponzi scheme. And I don't have any research. I don't have any academia backing me up on this, but my assumption, just from my gut, is that the vast majority of Ponzi schemes are that exact same way, where out legit.
I think that's a decent hunch.
Yeah. So even with that, you go, any red flags that would have been out front, but that at the beginning it was legit. So there weren't.
Right.
So,
and that's what he claimed.
They were fake, like, red flags.
Yeah. And that's what he tried to claim too. And, like, you know, on the prosecutor side, like, I don't remember which account it was, but one of the U.S. attorney was like, this is what people always do. They try to distract from their illegal activity by pointing to their legitimate business activity.
Right, right.
And that's what Berg did in this case, is when he was trying to say, like, well, no, this was all above board, blah, 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 blah. And then they're like, until you started stealing the money.
Right, right, right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, precisely. But along with that, because, like I was saying, the low or modest returns, mm-hmm, that were promised on, and maybe not even promised, that the people had been receiving on these investments, that was one thing that helped, I think helped make people feel like everything was legit.
For sure.
But I thought the most telling thing was, and we referenced him earlier in the podcast, one of Berg's victims was a former assistant U.S. attorney,
yes,
who had prosecuted people who were accused of running Ponzi schemes. And that guy never became suspicious of Berg.
Right.
And he even says that among all the people that he'd invested with, Berg was the most convincing and seemed the most trustworthy.
Yep.
And that, if somebody whose job was prosecuting Ponzi scheme people says that about you, that means if a Ponzi prosecutor can get duped into investing in a Ponzi scheme, then I contest that all of us have already been duped into investing in a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
And we're all screwed. Yeah. You'll never retire, give up your dreams of the Mai Tais on the beach.
Right. Yeah. And do you remember what that guy said at the end of that paragraph?
Yeah, fuck Darren Berg. Was that what? Maybe that was a
no.
I can't remember.
I mean, he may have said that, but he also said it was right after he said he was the most convincing person that he had ever met.
Uh-huh.
But then he said, "But I've never met a sociopath I didn't like."
Oh, okay.
Oh, gotcha. I'm like, yep,
that's a good line.
It's a good line.
There's a good line. Yeah,
I mean, it's funny. It's like, you know, you read about these victims and you listen. To, you know, their accounts in the podcast, or you watch the American, whatever. It's like, it's fucking awful, right? But, like, every once in a while, when somebody's got a, you know, when somebody throws a little humor in there, they have a little bit of sense of humor about it. It's like,
yeah.
See, some people are okay.
Yeah. It's a coping mechanism.
Totally.
So
totally.
And then I think the last thing, and again, this wasn't something I learned, but something that was reinforced. We've talked about it many times on the podcast, is I am exhausted thinking about the amount of work that Darren Berg had to do to just keep this fraud going. The the PO boxes is above and beyond. I don't know, like, you know, that's exhausting thinking about that.
It's just so hard to believe that he would do all that.
Right.
But when you kind of look at what was at stake for him, then you're like, of course.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to stay up all night and
right.
I'm going to fake all these confirmations, because if I don't, I'm going down.
Fake all the confirmations, fake my contract as a private jet consultant, fake my loan documents, fake my title reports, fake all this stuff. I just go, oh, I am so, yeah, I need a nap just thinking about how much work that is. And like you said, it makes sense, because his ass is in a sling if he can't keep all these plates spinning.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I don't want to be a nonstop. I don't want to be, I mean, I, listen, I would love to be a professional plate spinner.
Right.
That's a skill that I wish desperately that
sounds
I had.
Sounds great.
But I don't want to do more than about a 5-minute act, maybe 10 minutes tops. Yeah, right. If I had to spin plates nonstop for how many years with this?
He did it for over a decade. Yeah, over a decade.
No, forget it. Fuck that. You're already living in hell having to do that. So those are my big takeaways from Darren Berg. So, what about you? Anything really stick out to you?
No, I mean it's all pretty classic, you know, classic Ponzi scheme, a timeless investment scam, Greg.
Yeah.
So my question for you is, do you think he had the escape plan the whole time?
No.
No.
Nope. Because I am convinced that you don't know where you're going until you're sentenced.
True.
And I think likely he wound up there, and then he was like, oh, I can totally get out of this. And clearly he had friends, and he had more money stashed that he didn't find. That was his whole... Once things started going down the tubes, obviously his ADHD energy that he had, he redirected it from faking confirmations to hiding assets.
Yeah.
And
there's a Seattle Times article where they basically said, this is basically the Shawshank Redemption, except he didn't have to crawl through a pipe full of shit.
He just had to kind of, like,
yeah, he just had to walk. He just
look around and go, I think nobody's looking. I'm just going to leave.
And apparently, I think it was the American Greed episode, but that apparently that prison, that camp, or it's a camp. It isn't, it's not the penitentiary. It's the camp, but that camp is like right next to an airport.
Oh,
so, you know, like whoever helped him just like brought a change of clothes, you know, I don't know if he would have been able to get like, if you imagine, we talked about this in a previous episode, like how you would escape or how you would disappear.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
He figured like he clearly had help, but they figured it out and they just hopped on a plane, like probably right there. And then they were gone.
I think he had the resources available still.
Yeah.
My guess is that Blankenship, his boyfriend, was integral to getting him out of there. This is my speculation.
Yeah.
And that, I didn't know that there was an airport right by the prison camp. But like, okay, I'm going to have a Cessna that's going to touch down, won't come to a complete stop, and you've got to jog to get in the side door that I'll kick open for you, and then we'll just take right back off, and that's how we get out of there. So
it's fuck, man. I mean, I feel for the victims, but I feel for the victims, and this is a hell of a story.
It is. It is. And now I think I'm going to put J.A. Jantz's book Clawback on my on my Christmas wish list for this year.
Yeah, I kind of want to read it too, actually.
Well, that's it for this episode. And remember, a good Ponzi scheme can make your childhood dreams come true, at least for a while.
And also remember, when you escape from prison, the least you can do is leave a note letting everyone know that you'll be hiding out, racked with paranoia, and some rat-infested, mosquito-ridden dunghole fearing for your shitty life.
If you want to drop us a line, please do send us an email at ohmyfraud@earmarkcpe.com. Caleb, if people want to contact with you, connect with you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
LinkedIn/Caleb Newquist. Greg, have you read it? Which subreddit are you trolling most days?
I will go into Reddit when forced. That's about it. Like I think you sent me, I want to say you sent me an accounting subreddit for something for the podcast.
It was for because Tony Menendez did an AMA.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't ask me anything.
So that's a long time ago. So Reddit's not, that's not, and I
all right, I never barely, mind. Greg's not on Reddit, everybody.
Nope,
sorry about that.
You can't find me there. But I think I am on there, and all of my social handles are at Greg Kite, and even LinkedIn. That's probably the best place to try to connect with me. And I am just Greg Kite CPA on LinkedIn.
Oh My Fraud is written by Greg Kite and myself. Our producer is Zach Frank. Rate, review, and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you listen on Earmark, you can get free CPE. Outstanding.
Amazing.
Join us next time for more avarice, swindlers, and scams from stories that will make you say, oh, my fraud.